quiet moment, and then she looked at the family and she said, "Well, I really admire his persistence." And persistent he is. There's an ancient fable that imagines that one day the devil put his tools up for sale at public auction. The day they were to be on sale, they were out in display so that the potential purchasers could look over the treacherous lot. And you can imagine what a treacherous lot it was. There was deceit and lying and stealing and cheating and murder and 100 other tools, each with a price tag attached. Over to the side, according to the fable, there was a rather harmless-looking tool, very well-worn, with an extremely high price tag. A potential purchaser was fascinated by the tool and went to the devil who was conducting the auction and asked what it was. The devil said that that was his tool called discouragement. Said the purchaser, "Why such a high price tag?" The response was, "Because it is more useful to me than all the others. I can pry open and get inside a man's heart with that when I cannot get near with the other tools. It is badly worn because I use it on almost everyone, since so few people know it belongs to me." When you think of the persistence of the enemy, of Satan, when you think of the tools that he uses in our lives, somewhere along the line, discouragement has got to surface. And I suspect for most of us in our lives, it's very, very high on the list. I know what it is to struggle with discouragement. My guess is that you know what it is to struggle with discouragement. It's one of Satan's tools that's designed to neutralize us in the battle for the kingdom. It's designed to alienate us against God. It's designed to militarize us against each other. Discouragement is one of the most persistent, one of the most devastating, and one of the most hurtful and harmful tools that Satan uses in our lives. The Southern Baptist denomination is the largest Protestant denomination in the world. At their recent annual convention, they announced that they have 1,000 pastors a year that resign from Christian ministry. The primary reason, said the president, was discouragement. It was just a couple of years ago that I was here in the conference grounds speaking, and a Christian worker, who was a very prominent person across Canada, was here on the conference grounds on that Saturday afternoon. We sat over in the lounge, and for about an hour and a half, I tried to encourage him because he was discouraged. I had no idea how discouraged he was. 3 weeks later, he committed suicide. Discouragement is one of the most lethal and devastating tools that Satan uses to marginalize us in our work for the kingdom and in our walk for God. Well, when I analyze my problems with discouragement, and when I try to get a hold and a handle on the discouragement in the lives of friends of mine that I have an opportunity to talk to, I almost invariably discover that sometimes the discouragement is because of an overwhelming sense of failure in their past. Sometimes it's because of an overwhelming sense of frustration with their present. And then sometimes it's because of an overwhelming sense of fear looking down the road, what they're going to face, what's before them. Those are the three factors that I suspect for many of us in our lives. are really the launching pad. They're really the leverage that Satan uses to pry his way into our lives and to discourage us. The children of Israel, 38 years wandering around the wilderness, had every reason to be discouraged, if those are the reasons why people get discouraged. All they had to do was look in their recent past and look at their failure. All they had to do was look at their present. All the frustration of 38 years going nowhere, absolutely slowly, must have been very frustrating. All they had to do is look at their immediate future. They're someday going to be moving toward the land. They're going to face the Canaanites. I suggest to you that whether they look back, whether they looked around, or whether they look down into the future, they had every reason in the world to struggle with the problem of being discouraged. So Moses writes a story. And the story is designed to offer them an antidote to discouragement. If you've got your Bible, let me invite you to turn to Genesis chapter 28. It's a familiar story to us. We probably haven't looked at the story in the light of the context we're going to be looking at it tonight. In Genesis chapter 28, we break into the middle of the life of Jacob. And the setting for the story we're going to look at begins in verse 10 of Genesis chapter 28. It says, "Then Jacob departed from Beersheba and went toward Haran. And he came to a certain place and spent the night there because the sun had set. And he took one of the stones of the place and put it under his head, and lay down in that place." Now, if our understanding, friends, about this dynamic of discouragement is true, I don't have any difficulty at all imagining that as Jacob puts his head on that stony pillow, as he wraps himself in his only blanket, a bright, starry eastern sky, and as he tries to go off to sleep that night, he is a very discouraged man. All he had to do was to look back on his recent past. And it was just jam-packed with failure. He had cheated his brother. He had lied and tricked his father. All he had to do was to take a look at his face in the mirror, and he saw nothing to be proud of, everything to be ashamed of. It's that kind of reflection. It's that kind of memory. It's that type of reflection upon last week, last month, last year. That sense of failure that's calculated to discourage. All he had to do was look at his present, and there was nothing in his present that helped him deal with his discouragement. Frustrated? Every reason to be frustrated. He was supposed to be the father of multitudes. And here he is out in the desert, absolutely alone, forsaken by his family without a soul around him. He's supposed to be the possessor of all the land. Everything he owns is on a little knapsack that he's carrying on his back. He's supposed to have preeminence over his brother Esau, who he's tricked out of the birthright. What he's doing is he's fleeing from Esau for his very life. Frustrated? Every reason to be frustrated. And that's what discourages people. Frustration in their present situation. Afraid in the future? He looked at tomorrow. He was going to be packing his bag and heading out in a journey toward Haran. It was a very treacherous trip he would be taking. He's going to be traveling all alone. He was going to be open game and prey for all of the robbers and all of the gangsters that would be along the way. He had every reason to be scared to death. And to complicate it, he was on his way looking for a wife. And that's a frightening experience under the best of circumstances. So as Jacob goes to sleep at night, I want you to sense his pulse. I want you to feel his emotion. He looks back and sees such failure in his past, he's got every reason to be discouraged. He looks around, there's such frustration in his present, he's got every reason to be discouraged. He looks ahead, and there's such fear as he anticipates the future, he's got every reason to be discouraged. And what God does is visit him in the midst of that discouragement with the antidote. The antidote is given, first of all, in a symbolic way, and then it's interpreted and given to us in a verbal way. What you've got in the rest of the chapter is a story with two movements. In verses 12 down to verse 15, you've got the revelation of God to Jacob. And then beginning at verse 16 down to the end of the chapter, you've got the response of Jacob to God. Well, let's look first of all then at the revelation of God to Jacob in verses 12 through 15. That revelation is first of all given in a symbolic way. In verse 12 we read, he had a dream. Now there are three parts to the dream, and in my translation at least, each part is introduced with the word behold. It says, and behold, a ladder was set on the earth, with its top reaching to heaven, and behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it, and behold, the Lord stood above it. Now that's the revelation. It is a symbol. It's a dream. In the dream, he sees something that's very, very symbolic. The symbolic revelation is very obviously built into three components. There's that ladder, right, the foot of the ladder, right where he is, and the head of the ladder, right up in heaven. And there are the angels of God ascending and descending, and there's God standing right at the top of the ladder. For centuries, Christians have argued over what on earth the ladder represents. Some people have thought that it represents the church, because the church is the connection between earth and heaven, and it's through the church that you go from earth to heaven. And some people have thought that the ladder represents faith, because the way earth makes contact with heaven, and the way men and women on earth have access to heaven is by faith. As some people have thought that the ladder represents the Christian pilgrimage. That's the famous Negro spiritual. We are climbing Jacob's ladder. And that great Negro spiritual visualizes the ladder sort of as a Christian pilgrimage. We're on our way, climbing that ladder on our way to heaven. As some people suggest that the ladder represents the incarnation. And we need to stop just for a moment and address that question, because there's some basis for that. If you've got your Bible, slip over to John chapter 1, please. John chapter 1. Let me remind you of a very, very familiar scene. We'll pick it up in verse 43. John chapter 1, verse 43. It says, the next day Jesus purposed to go forth to Galilee. He found Philip, and Jesus said to him, follow me. I'm sorry, verse 44. Now Philip was from Bethsaida, of the city of Andrew and Peter. Philip found Nathanael and said to him, we have found him of whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph. And Nathanael said to him, can any good thing come out of Nazareth? Philip said to him, come and see. Jesus saw Nathanael coming to him and said to him, behold, an Israelite, indeed, in whom is no guile. Now I need to just stop at that point and remind you that the name of Jacob means guile. So in fact, literally, to the Jewish mind, what Jesus says is, behold, an Israelite in whom there is no Jacob. It's a very interesting allusion. Verse 48, Nathanael said to him, how do you know me? Jesus answered and said to him, before Philip called you, when you were under the fig tree, I saw you. That's one of the demonstrations in the Gospel of John of the deity of Christ. One of the ways that John argues that Jesus is God, that he is the Son of God, is that he is the omniscient one, that he knows. And you just think through some of the stories in the Gospel of John. And over again, the emphasis is that Jesus knows. Jesus sees the heart. Jesus understands. He is the omniscient one. And so what he's saying here is, before Philip ever called you, Nathanael, I know that you were reclining in your afternoon siesta under a fig tree over there. Well, what on earth do you think he was doing under that fig tree during that time of siesta? Well, I've got a radical suggestion for you. It says in verse 49, Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel. Jesus answered and said to him, Because I said to you that I saw you under the fig tree, do you believe? You shall see greater things than this. And he said, Truly, truly, I say to you, you shall see the heavens opened and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man. This is a direct allusion to Jacob's dream. Now, what our Lord is not saying is that the latter represents the incarnation, Jesus Christ, the Son of God, with angels ascending, descending, access to heaven. But what he does do is he applies that latter to himself. So it's an application of it. That's obviously not the meaning of it, because it would have been absolutely meaningless to Jacob in that way. So the question that we're left with is that while the latter is used by our Lord and applied to him as a symbol of the incarnation with all kinds of New Testament understanding, that's obviously not what it means to Jacob. The question is, what does it mean to Jacob that night? Here he is laying on the stone, and he's having his dream, and he's a devastated and discouraged man, and God comes and gives him a dream, and there in that dream he sees the ladder and he sees the angels and he sees God. What's it mean? Well, I think the commentators who go on and suggest that what is revealed to Jacob symbolically in the ladder is now interpreted to Jacob verbally by our Lord. Let me explain. Come on with me in our reading, and you'll see in verse 13, now the Lord is going to interpret that ladder for Jacob. It says, I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham, the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give it to you and to your descendants. So what he's now doing is renewing the Abrahamic covenant promises. Your descendants shall also be like the dust of the earth, and you shall spread out to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south, and in you and in your descendants shall all the families of the earth be blessed. And behold, there's our key word. That was the word that tied in those three elements that were involved in the vision. And behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go and will bring you back to this land. For I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. I suggest to you, friends, this evening, that the significance of that ladder, with the angels ascending and descending, and God standing right at the top of that ladder, is that it's a message to Jacob that God was going to be with him, that his presence could be absolutely counted upon, and that the angels of God would be always continuously active, carrying to heaven his petitions and his concerns and his problems, and bringing from heaven down to Jacob God's answers and God's provisions and God's protection. There's a sense in which, in the midst of that dream, God comes to Jacob and he says, Jacob, wherever you are, whatever the circumstance, whatever the situation is, I want you to know there will always be a ladder. And that ladder will be from that very spot where you are. It's going to reach right into heaven where I am. I'm going to be standing right at the top of that ladder, and all of my angelic hosts are going to be actively involved, going back and forth between you and me in order to provide for you, in order to protect you, in order to preserve you. And that's going to continue, Jacob, until I have fulfilled every promise I've made for you and I've completed every purpose I have for you in your life. That, ladies and gentlemen, is the divine antidote to satanic discouragement. Symbolically, it's a ladder. Theologically, it is the continuing, abiding presence of God with the ministry of angels and with a faithful God standing to assure that every single promise He's made to us is going to be fulfilled. And He's going to continue doing that until all of His purposes for us are realized. That's the antidote I propose. God's antidote for satanic discouragement. One of the problems with evangelicalism in the day in which we live is we take for granted one of the most marvelous doctrines of our Christian faith. It's the truth of the abiding presence of God. There was a church in the Midwest a few years ago that had a pastor who wrote a little word of instruction to his congregation and put it on the inside of the church bulletin one Sunday. The pastoral note said this: there have been a number of people leaving the church a few minutes after they have received Holy Communion. This is a great dishonor to our blessed Lord. The church tells us Jesus remains in our bodies 15 minutes after we have received Holy Communion. That means that our thanksgiving should be at least 15 minutes long. We should not leave the church until our Lord is no longer with us. Now, how would you like to go to a church that would say that in its church bulletin? Well, you see, most of us are extremely offended by that. One of the doctrines that we hold to is the abiding, constant presence of God. That God is with us. A Jewish peddler one day came to a Christian home, stepped inside selling his goods, noticed on the wall just inside the door an artist's conception of Jesus. Turned to the Christian woman of the house and asked if that was a picture of her Messiah. She said, indeed it was. He stood and looked at it, because under the picture there was a brief quotation from a New Testament text. The brief quotation said, "Lo, I am with you always." He stopped and looked, and looked, and looked. When he had sold his product, he turned to leave, turned back once more, looked at the picture, and said to the lady, "What a wonderful Messiah. He's always with you." That's the ladder. One of the wonderful ways that God teaches us through the Scriptures is through symbols. And we appreciate, in our evangelical heritage, the significance of symbols. We appreciate the significance of the bread. It means a great deal to us. Wasn't it thoughtful? Wasn't it wise? Wasn't it good of God to give us the symbol of the bread? We appreciate the cup. There's marvelous symbolism wrapped up, wonderful theological truths wrapped up in the cup. We appreciate the symbolism wrapped up in baptism. It's a symbol. And down through the history of the church, there have been other symbols that we have raised. Some of us appreciate the symbol of a cross. I know others are offended by it. But some of us appreciate the symbol of the cross. It has a message to it. It communicates. It recalls. It delivers. There's a great deal of significance to a cross. And some of us appreciate the symbol of a steeple. The steeple out in front of a church, it can be a very, very strong symbol. There's a message. There's something that it says to us. I want to suggest, with all the symbols that are part of your evangelical heritage, that one that you might like to add is the symbol of the ladder. And the message of the ladder to Jacob is the message of the ladder to every Christian in every generation who is struggling with satanic discouragement because of their sense of failure back there, or their sense of frustration with today, or their dread of fear about tomorrow. It's in that circumstance, in that situation, that faith sees a ladder. And on that ladder, all of the angels of God ascending and descending, God standing at the very head, masterminding and directing and superintending all of that activity in order to provide for us, and in order to protect us, and in order to preserve us, so that He will be with us until every single promise that He's ever made will be fulfilled, and all of His purposes will be realized. That's the significance of the ladder. Well, what on earth does it do for Jacob? Well, come with me to the rest of the story. In verses 12 through 15, then, you have the revelation of God to Jacob. Now you have Jacob's response to God, beginning at verse 16. Then Jacob awoke from his sleep. Surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it. He was afraid and said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God. This is the gate of heaven. Now I want you to notice two things in those two verses. The first thing that I want you to notice is that in spite of Jacob's dark past, the ladder assures Jacob that God is present with him in verse 16. Surely the Lord is in this place, and I didn't know it. I suspect that what he's thinking is that he left Yahweh back home with father and mother. And he's run from that scene, and he's out here in the midst of this desperate desert situation, and he's not convinced, he's not assured that God is with him. And that ladder, in spite of his past, gives him the assurance that God is with him. I'd like to say to you tonight, if you're struggling with a satanic attack of discouragement because of your overwhelming sense of failure last week or last year, the antidote is for faith to see the ladder, the symbol of God's presence and the faithful continuing ministry of the angels. And when faith sees that ladder right from that place, right where you are, when faith sees that ladder, it assures us of God's continuing presence with us in spite of our failure, in spite of how we've blown it in the past. I want you to know, I find that very encouraging. If that's not where you are tonight, then my guess is that's where some of you are going to be at some time during this next year. You're going to blow it. You're going to blow it. And Satan is going to take advantage of that failure. And when Satan takes advantage of that failure and you get discouraged, you're going to experience the same emotion that Jacob is experiencing. Where are you, God? I'm the last kind of wretch that you ought to be with. I've got absolutely no claim to have you as part of my life or part of my marriage or part of my family or part of my home or part of my business or part of my ministry. I've got no claim for you. As a matter of fact, I'm so discouraged, I don't even sense your presence. I don't even sense you with me. And I suspect to you, I propose to you, that the antidote in that given situation is going to be for faith to see the ladder. And that ladder symbolizing God is with me. And that ladder assures us, in spite of our failure, in spite of blowing it, in spite of our betrayals, in spite of all that's gone on and whatever has gone on, God is with us with all of the ministry of angels addressing our situation, and He's going to continue to be with us, He says to Jacob and He says to us, to fulfill every promise that He's ever made, and to complete all of the purposes that He's got for our lives. I submit to you, that is a marvelous antidote to satanic discouragement, especially when we're discouraged, when we look back. What about if we're discouraged because of our present circumstances? You can get discouraged because you find yourself in a situation that there just doesn't seem to be any way out. It can be a family situation, could be a health situation, can be a ministry situation, can be a relationship. You find yourself in a situation where you're going nowhere and you have nowhere to go. You've got no way of getting out of it. Satan takes advantage of that situation and boy, it's easy to get discouraged. The antidote is for faith to see the ladder. Right there, wherever you are, whatever the circumstance, in that situation that you're in right today, faith sees the ladder. Above that ladder, there's God. On that ladder are the millions of angels available to take our burdens and our petitions and our requests to God, to bring God's answers back, to protect us and to provide us. And God says that ladder is going to be there, that presence is going to be there until every promise is fulfilled and all of God's purposes for our lives are realized. That's the antidote to discouragement. We get in the midst of that present circumstance and present situation. Joshua saw it. He was about to move into the land, and as he struggled with life, he had all kinds of reasons to be discouraged. And what happens? God appears to him. He sees the ladder. And God assures Joshua that He's present with him, and He's going to be with him. And in the midst of all of his anxieties and all of his insecurities, it's that consciousness of the presence of God that just changes the circumstance and radically changes the situation that he's in. That's the way it's been down through the history of the church. John Bunyan, Bedford Jail, 12 years for preaching the gospel. He said he had such an overwhelming sense of the presence of God with him at Bedford Jail that when he wrote Pilgrim's Progress, he called that jail Palace Beautiful. See, that's what the sense of the presence of God does. It transforms the situation. Jacob looks around him. Before he goes to sleep, he's in the desert. All there are some rocks and some barren land. When he wakes up and realizes the ladder is there, he says, why, this is the house of God. This is Bethel. Why, this is the very gate to heaven. What the ladder has done is it's transformed his present circumstances so that he's freed and delivered from all of the satanic discouragement, and he sees it as the very house of God. It's what happened to Madame Guyon. She was confined to prison for her witness, the French Bastille, for 8 years. And in the midst of that experience, she wrote, strong are the walls around me that hold me all the day. But they who thus have bound me cannot keep God away. My very dungeon walls are dear because the God I love is here. They know who thus oppress me. 'Tis hard to be alone. But know not one can bless me who comes through bars and stone. He makes my dungeon's darkness bright and fills my bosom with delight. What does that for a woman like this? What does it, ladies and gentlemen, is that faith sees the ladder, the symbol of the presence of God. And it transforms the present circumstances and frees and delivers from that kind of discouragement. Well, there are lots of illustrations of it, and that's the very kind of thing that it can do in our lives. It's the antidote to satanic discouragement. What it does, in spite of the past, it assures us of God's presence. We don't deserve it, but He's still faithful and true with us. In the very midst of the presence, the latter transforms the circumstances. God is here. Hey, man, that changes the hospital room. That changes a marriage. That changes a family. That changes the office. That changes the factory. God is here. There's a ladder there. Here are the angels. There's God. It changes the present circumstances. And then finally, in regard to the future, what it does is give Jacob a whole new sense of courage and dedication. Verse 18 says, "So Jacob rose early in the morning. He took the stone that he had put under his head, set it up as a pillar, and poured oil on it. He called the name of the place Bethel. However, previously the name of the city had been called Luz. Then Jacob made a vow, 'If God will be with me and will keep me on this journey that I take, and will give me food to eat and garment to wear, and I return to my father's house in safety, then the Lord will be my God. This stone which I have set up as a pillar will be God's house. And of all that thou dost give me, I will surely give thee a tenth.'" Well, Bible teachers through the years have had a little difficulty with what Jacob does in this particular scene. Is he bartering with God? Is he making a deal with God? Well, I don't see it that way, and many Bible teachers don't see it that way. My understanding of what happens is helped by changing one little word in the text. Verse 20, "Then Jacob made a vow, saying, 'Since God will be with me.'" This in the grammarian language is what is called a first-class conditional. A first-class conditional is a conditional clause that begins with the word if or the word since, but the first part of it is assumed to be true. It's the kind of thing that is said when Satan comes to Jesus and says, "If you are the Son of God, change the stones." Now, he's not doubting that he's the Son of God. God has just announced that from heaven in the baptism. What he's saying is, "Since you're the Son of God, change these." That's the first class conditional. My understanding is that this is what we probably would call the moment of Jacob's conversion. This is when Jacob turns to God. He recognizes all that God is saying symbolized in that wonderful ladder, and then he says, in the light of all of this, verse 21, "Then the Lord will be my God." Up until now, you've been my father's God. You've been the God of our family and the God of my grandparents. But now you're going to be my God. This is his personal presentation of himself to the Lord as his God. Then he goes on and he expresses a purpose. His purpose is going to be to perpetuate this place as a scene of worship. He sets up a stone, he sets up a pillar, he calls this place Bethel. In due course, the tabernacle is going to be erected on this spot. And they're going to worship God in this spot, awaiting the building of the temple. And then finally, he makes a promise. "And I will surely give thee a tenth." The tithe in the Old Testament language was a symbolic way of expressing that everything I have belongs to God. When a harvest was taken, a tenth of that harvest was given to God. That was the Hebrews' way of saying, "I acknowledge that all of this harvest is God's." That was the significance of the tithe. When Jacob comes and says, "And of all that I've got, I will surely give a tenth unto you," Jacob is acknowledging the lordship, the rulership of God in his life, the ownership of God over all that he has. This is the moment of Jacob's personal faith in Yahweh as his God, and a moment of his total commitment and dedication to the Lord in his life. What is it that prompts it? Well, what prompts it is the ladder. He sees the ladder. He sees the presence of God. And that ladder changes his whole perspective regarding the future. He went to bed frightened to death about tomorrow and about next month. He wakes up and he's ready to take it on. The ladder, the consciousness, the sense of the presence of God gives him courage and hope and a whole new dimension and perspective on the future. I want to suggest to you for tonight, friends, that that's what the ladder will do in our lives as well. Some of us, as we've come to conference this week, might find ourselves very, very nervous, considerably frightened. about what faces us in the immediate future, or maybe in the more distant future. It's that kind of fear that Satan takes advantage of and discourages us. We become marginalized and neutralized. The antidote to that kind of discouragement is to see the ladder. And God's promise is that wherever you are tomorrow, wherever you are next month, wherever you are next week, next year, there's going to be a ladder. Whatever the situation, whatever the circumstance, there will be a ladder. And on that ladder, there will be all of the angelic hosts. Above that ladder, there will be the sovereign God. And that's going to be true until every one of his promises is fulfilled and all of his plans are realized in your life. What that does is it gives you confidence and assurance and hope as you look down into the future. You see, what I'm saying is this. For every one of us who are Christians here this evening, one of the most elementary aspects of our Christian faith is the presence of God. We take it so for granted that when we get overcome with a sense of failure because of the past, or frustration with the present, or fear about the future, Satan moves in and discourages us. And we lose a grip on a doctrine, on a truth that is calculated to, it's calculated to give us the assurance that in spite of all of our past, God is still faithful and true to us. In spite of all of the mess that we're in tonight, God is still involved. In spite of all of the hazards and dangers and uncertainties, God has still got promises. It's the latter. And so what I want is to get up in the morning and to go through my day and to go through the years ahead of me, and by faith to see a ladder and to see those angels and to hear God. That's the kind of thing that effectively deals with the kind of discouragement that Satan uses to wipe us out day after day in our Christian life. Well, there's lots of stories that can illustrate it. David Livingstone, when he was leaving his home in Scotland, met with his family in their family living room, and they read and prayed. They read Psalm 121, a great psalm that was intended to be a great blessing. I will look unto the hills. From whence cometh my help? My help cometh from the Lord. He goes out to Africa. On January the 14th, 1856, he said, I felt much turmoil of spirit in the prospect of having all my plans for the welfare of this great region and this teeming population knocked on the head by savages tomorrow. But Jesus said, all power is given unto me in heaven and on earth. Go therefore and teach all nations, and lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. That was David Livingstone's life text. Lo, I am with you always, even unto the end of the age. When friends were saying farewell to him as he was going out on his very first missionary venture, they warned him of the dangers and the hazards that were ahead of him. He responded to them by reading that text from the Great Commission, and then he said, this is the word of a gentleman of the most strict and sacred honor. Let us be going. See, the explanation of David Livingstone's life was that he saw a ladder, saw the ministry of the angels, he saw God. That was the truth that made the difference in Livingstone's life. It was the awareness, it was the consciousness, it was the sense that God is with me. Made all the difference in his life. Hudson Taylor said, all of God's giants have been weak men who did great things for God because they reckoned on his being with them. That's the truth. That's the message. Now what I want you to take with you from tonight is that wherever you're going to be, friend, whatever the circumstance you're going to be in, whatever the situation that surrounds you, what I want to encourage you to develop
is the discipline of faith that visualizes a ladder, that sees the angels, that hears God saying, wherever you are, whatever the circumstance, there will be a ladder. Right from your bedroom, right from your hospital room, right from your office, right from that relationship, right into heaven. And that ladder is going to be there until every promise I've ever made to you is fulfilled and all of my plans are absolutely realized. It's that sense of living with the consciousness, the awareness of the presence of God that I think is God's antidote to satanic discouragement. If you were to visit Westminster Abbey, you would discover there's a monument that's raised to John Wesley. Three quotes, three statements are on that wonderful, wonderful monument. Three great quotes that come from his life. One statement, God buries his workmen, but continues his work. Another statement, all the world is my parish. The third statement was this, was his last words that are recorded. He was laying in his deathbed, said them once, and then raised his arm just slightly and pointing his finger, he repeated them a second time. His final words, and the best of all, is that God is with us. And that really is true.